As I mentioned earlier, I spoke with Madeline Peyrou recently. I saw her years ago at a little club in Hyde Park, and it was just mesmerizing. And I was thrilled to see that she's coming to the Capitol Theater in May. But the reason I spoke to her was that her breakthrough album, Careless Love, was recently reissued. It was her second album, but it didn't come out until 8 years after her first. So in our conversation, I started by asking her what happened. Is it that the album took a long time to make, or was it just a long time before she felt like making an album? And as you'll hear, she has quite a story.
A lot of things happened. You wouldn't know a lot of things had happened because nobody heard anything from me. I made my first record in 1994. It came out in 96. I went on tour and started losing my voice before the end of 97. Went into the studio in 1998 and lost my voice during the session. We postponed the recording, and within a year, the label that I was with was purchased, or there was a merger. Atlantic Records downsized considerably, and I guess you could say I was dropped. But my A&R person at Atlantic Records said he was going to work for Sony. They would let him bring one artist with him, and he said, I want to take you over to Sony. So I signed a deal with Columbia Records in 2000. So years keep going by, right? And in 2001, I was getting ready to make this record. I did a concert in a little bar, and somebody from the label came down and said that he didn't like it. So they dropped me from Sony in 2002. I wasn't able to tour on my own. I went to my agent and asked if he would book me, and he said that he only wanted to do it when I had a record coming out. So I considered it as maybe an omen that I shouldn't have this as a career, and I wasn't really meant to be a singer anyway. And I went through a period of driving around the United States with a truck and visiting family members that I had just met and trying to get my voice back, but at the same time, not really having a direct path to any particular goal. And eventually, I discovered that I was really bad at everything else I tried to do. But no matter where I was, I could make money playing music. I would find a way. For example, I was waitressing, and on some days, I wasn't making enough to pay for my gas money to and from work. And I was exhausted and confused about the whole thing. And on the way home, I stopped at a little bar called the Blues Hideaway. The owner had just purchased it and wanted to transform it into a blues club. And I auditioned, and bam, she hired me 5 nights a week, solo, guaranteed cash and food. It was just such an omen. And I just said, okay, I have to give in to this. And so I had to learn to give in a little bit, but also to take control of my life a little bit at the same time. And eventually I heard from Rounder Records. I was gigging again. I was booking myself. We struck a deal. And then in 2004, I recorded Careless Love. So that's the really long answer. I apologize. If you wanted me to find a better way to put it together.
No, it's an interview, so the idea is that you talk, so.
All right. Well, be careful what you ask for, yeah.
It may be a sign of how petty I am, but as well as the album did you just kind of feel a bit of ha-ha to your old record label?
Well, yeah. What I felt was I was being held responsible for not putting a record out, when in truth I felt like the system was part of the problem. Even to this day, the standard contract of a record label is a bit of a sharecropper's deal, to be honest. And there are a lot of issues around copyright and ownership of things, and of course freedom to choose. I mean, at this point I was just glad to do what I did, and I did not expect Careless Love to become, to this day, it's the most popular record that I made. And I've tried to continue making records ever since. I've had more agency and more drive.
It wasn't just that the record was a success. You covered all these iconic artists, Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Hank Williams, and then one of the big hits on the album is Don't Wait Too Long, which you wrote. What was that like?
It really is a surprise when people like a song like that. And I often thought, it's not really a good song. People are just having a good time. But it's been a long time now, and I still grow into it. I suppose the theory that I have is that if a person finds a way to express a real truth of their own, something that really finds who they are, it's going to translate into art, meaning it's going to translate into that quiet conversation between or among many souls. This sort of ability to share information without knowing that you're doing it. Yeah.
You once said that you thought the reason the album did so well is that it speaks of love, not as something you're waiting for someone to give you, but as something you generate within yourself about yourself. Is that what you mean? And don't wait too long when you say, take a chance, play your part, make romance, it might break your heart, that you've got to go for what you want?
Oh, yeah, I think that's what the song is about. I had just been through years of wandering in the wilderness, questioning my own path and also questioning the world. By the time I wrote Don't Wait Too Long, I was talking to myself. I was saying, look, let's do something. So I'm really glad that it works for other people because it's been helpful this year to start singing that song again.
How hard has the year been for you in terms of not being able to perform?
I think musicians all around me are saying this. When you finally play with people and for people in the same room, you have almost a cellular rejuvenation that comes on. I don't think music really exists in the same way if it's just you and your instrument by yourself. And there's no other way to really recreate that. It's like not having a certain nutrient in your diet for a year, I think.
I know that you busked as a teenager in Paris, and I read that you turned down a recording contract to keep doing it. And I thought, well, that's unusual.
That's exactly what happened.
What was so compelling about that life?
Mm-hmm. A lot of people that I know that are still around from those days, we keep in touch and we have fond, warm thoughts, not just memories, but ideas that came from having that experience. I suppose you could try to compare it to a bunch of different things that are a bit experimental. The adventure and the excitement that could come from perhaps, say, creating a commune, having that freedom, that idea that we're creating our society. We chose to be here together. We all share certain ideals, but not many. But the ones that we do are the important ones, which is we take care of each other, just like any community. We all work, just like any community. And to a certain extent, each according to their ability. Of course, that depends on who you talk to. But I think in our group, there were people that were lesser musicians, people that knew less, people that were just children when they started, like myself. And we were given something to do. Here's something you can do. And then we were fed and taken care of, and we went on the road and we did things. And the only thing that was negative that might befall somebody was if they were being self-destructive. But nobody ever hurt each other. There was always this sense of purpose to get up and play music for people. I mean, how easy, you know? You learn music because of the people you're playing with. You go there kind of when you want to, but you do it in a way that will make money. So you find the right time in the right place, but you don't have a bank account. You don't have a phone. You don't have any tethers, really. And so you don't care about, there's so many things that you don't care about. And then there's this open-ended side of your life when you sit down and you're not in the middle of working, when you have time to just be and to think. I suppose you could easily argue that there is some escapism involved in the whole way of life. And ironically, it is good to be an escapist if you're a musician, because you want to be able to share that ability with your audience. You want music to be a gateway. So I thought it was really magical, and a lot of us still do. And there are a couple of people from that era that were my age that are still doing it, and they've created a way of doing it with a home, a house, children that are off at college. They have a little Winnebago with some basic amenities, and they stay in parks and camper grounds all around Europe, but they drive into town and play music and then drive back out. And they do this almost half the year all the time.
The next time a record label gives you so much grief, you just say, screw it, I'm getting in my Winnebago.
Of course I've thought of that, Marcy, of course. I don't know if I'll be as good at it anymore, but the point is we can have more freedom than we realize, more agency than we realize. That's the lesson. And if you're really cool, if you're really lucky, then you can find a way to create a life with your own agency and your own freedom that has love in it, whether that's because music is the way to go or some other way.
Madeline Peyrou, from her recently reissued breakthrough album, Careless Love, and Don't Wait Too Long.